So the title of this presentation is Who Am I or CPU ID on the PDP-8. So this talk is not going to be about me. The question Who Am I is rather from the perspective of the code that's running on the computer. But short presentation about me, computer enthusiast and collector for many years. I'm sort of representing Update, as you can see on my shirt. We are a computer club in Uppsala, Sweden, and I encourage you to check us out. It's a simple Google search away, or DuckDuckGo if you prefer. And you can support us by becoming members or buying lovely sweaters like this one. Okay, so on to the talk. What is CPU ID? So it's essentially any code that can identify the CPU model on which is executing the code. It might also become more specific and try to identify the system rather than just the CPU model. And why would you want to identify the CPU you're running on? Probably because you want to handle some portable code. Maybe you want to handle small differences among CPU models, or you want to exploit some system-specific feature for performance or allowing for features in your software. Or perhaps you want to avoid system-specific features. For instance, there was on some Pentium models, there were instructions introduced to increase performance. But in later models, these instructions were deprecated, and you would actually have worse performance if you use them. So here it becomes important to know which CPU you're executing on. So how do you do this? Well, on x86, there is an instruction called CPU ID, and it will give you a model-specific value that you can look up in a table, and you will know what model you're executing on. Okay, so that's it then. No more mysteries. But the CPU ID may lie. Perhaps you're running on a bootleg version of the hardware, and you really want to know. And more interesting for this talk is that there is no CPU ID instruction on the PDP-8, so you need some other kind of tricks to identify your CPU. So how do we do it then? Well, let's explore how Kermit 12 does it. Kermit 12 is software for the PDP-8 family of computers. It implements the Kermit protocol, a file transfer protocol. It runs on all PDP-8 compatibles, at least those made by Digital Equipment Corporation. And since it is a protocol to transfer data over a serial line, it must handle the I/O peculiarities of the CPU you're executing on. So what's the purpose of CPU ID in Kermit 12? Well, as I said, you have to handle the I/O incompatibilities, specifically on the DeckMate line of computers. But it also will show a prompt with your system model in the prompt. So when you have logged in on a PDP-8 that may be remote to you, the Kermit program will tell you what CPU model you're on. The rest of the Kermit 12 code has been written to use only the subset of instructions that is compatible on all PDP-8 models. So it's really only do these two things that is necessary, that requires knowledge about the CPU model. So it handles this with a subroutine called machine, and this particular part of Kermit 12, which has been written by several people over the years, was written by Charles Lessner. So I just want to spend a slide here talking about Charles. So who was Charles? He was really a guru in the true sense of the word for everything PDP-8. He started the Altsys PDP-8 news group. He developed his own operating system called PS8, and he maintained Kermit 12 and made the last release in 1992. He unfortunately passed away last year, and he is missed by the community. You would send him a question and he would give you a long and detailed reply, not only for the question you asked, but for several other questions that you didn't know you had. He was really a fountain of knowledge for PDP-8 things. Okay, so before we dive into the Kermit 12 code, I'm going to give you a bit of background of PDP-8 computers. Perhaps you already have heard of them and maybe seen some, but we're going to talk a little bit about the different models, and I'm going to talk about how to write code for a PDP-8 so that we can hopefully understand the code listings that I will be showing further on. So it's a family of 12-bit computers made by Digital Equipment Corporation. It was introduced in 1965, or in 1963 if you count the PDP-5. And for this talk, we are including the PDP-5. The line of computers was discontinued in 1990 with the release of the DeckMate 3. And PDP-8s really have been used everywhere, from industrial control to big screens on the sports stadiums to word processing, but also in research laboratories on many universities. And here is my sort of timeline of the different models released and their relationship. So I have included here all the DEC models. I've also included the Link computer in the top left corner. The Link computer is not PDP-8 compatible. It's a 12-bit machine, but it's one's complement, whereas the PDP-8 is a two's complement computer, and the instruction set is quite different. It's included here just to show the relationship with the Link-8 computer. But as I said, the model was introduced. The line was introduced in 1963 with the PDP-5, designed by Edson De Castro. He's most famous, I guess, for leaving Digital Equipment when his proposal for the PDP-11 was not accepted. So he left and he started Data General, which became a quite successful company in its own right. But the PDP-5 was a success. It was used a lot by the American Navy, and it showed that there was a commercial space for smaller mini computers. So in 1965, the PDP-8 was introduced, which is mostly compatible with the PDP-5, but it was built using the new flip chip technology, whereas the PDP-5 was built using the system building blocks, the same modules used to build the PDP-1, PDP-7, PDP-4. So the first model is called the Straight 8, as it has no letter designating the model number. Quickly afterwards, the PDP-8S was introduced, and this was a strong wish from DEC's CEO Ken Olson to introduce an even cheaper version. Otherwise, the PDP-8 is known for being the first serially produced computer under $20,000, but they made this cost reduce S version, which is bit serial, which makes it fairly slow, almost 10 times slower than the straight 8 in some cases. So some say the S stands for slow, but perhaps it stands for serial as well. At the same time, the Link 8 was introduced. This was a way for Link customers to upgrade and to get access to the growing library of PDP-8 software. It's a rather interesting architecture where the PDP-8 CPU sort of drives the Link CPU as an IO peripheral, and I think it also requires some software in order to properly execute Link code. And interesting to note that it's then both a ones complement computer and a twos complement computer at the same time. In 1968, the PDP-8i and L was introduced. So this is the first models built using integrated circuits. The 5, 8, S, and Link 8 are all made with discrete transistors, but here it's built using 74 logic. So the 8i is the bigger machine of the two, and the L is the cost reduced version. This time it's not at all slower, it's just that there is less room for expansion within the CPU enclosure, so a smaller and cheaper backplane. So this is the modernization of the PDP-8 using integrated circuits. Then the PDP-12 is the modernization of the Link 8 using integrated circuits. So this is the Link 8, but based around a 8i CPU rather than a straight 8 CPU in the Link 8. And the Link part is more complete and a CPU in its own right, so it doesn't rely as heavily on the 8 CPU. It's worth noting though that while it is a computer with two CPUs, they cannot run in parallel. It's either one or the other, and you have instructions to switch between the two. In 1970, the scale of integration had increased, so a new CPU model, the PDP-8E, F, and M, was introduced, which is even smaller than the 8i, and I suppose also cheaper. The big change, though, between the i and the e is the introduction of the Omnibus. So it's a generic bus to attach peripherals, which is much more flexible and future-proof compared to the maybe I should use the word monolithic, the big backplane in the 8i with predetermined positions for expansions. The FNM is just different packaging of the same 8e CPU. Again, in 1975, the integration scale has increased, and the new CPU, the 8A CPU, is even smaller and a complete redesign. However, it's actually slightly slower than the 8E, so some 8A models were delivered with the 8E CPU, requiring a slightly, I think, different power supply depending on the memory, depending on the memory option chosen. So the last two models are the integrated versions. The first is the I have to check my notes. The Intersil 6100. So it's an a PDP-8 in a one IC capsule, a micro processor, if you like. Just 2 years later, the 6120 was introduced, which included a memory controller for extended memory. It was available for the 6100 as well, but required extra chips on in order to use the full 32K memory space of the PDP-8A. Sorry, the PDP-8 instruction set. Okay, so these are all the models, and all the models that can be identified using the machine subroutine. Still, we're not ready to dive into the code. I was going to give you a really, really quick introduction to PDP-8 assembly. The PDP-8 instruction sets comes with three types of instructions. They are either memory referencing, they are I/O instructions, or they are what's called operate instructions. Let's start out with a small code example showing the simplest memory referencing instructions. I hope you can read this. Give me a thumbs up if you can.
Yeah, it's big enough. It's really good.
Okay, good. Thank you. So the first line is a 2's complement addition. So this will take the contents of a memory location and add it to the really the only register available to you as a programmer, the accumulator. So the zero here would be the memory address. So this means take the contents of location zero and add it to the accumulator. Conversely, you can store the contents of the accumulator in memory location, in this example, memory location one, using the deposit and clear accumulator instruction. The most assemblers would give you some syntactic sugar. So here, putting a value in parentheses, 4711 here, means that the assembler will put a constant somewhere in memory, and you can refer to that constant. Just putting the value in brackets, it would automatically get the address generated for you. You can also use labels, such as the label foo here on the last line, which allows you to put a value somewhere in memory, which you can reference using the symbol foo. So here is then a list of all the memory referencing instructions. First, you have the AND instruction, which just ANDs a memory value to the accumulator. The addition instruction that I talked about. Then you have increment and skip if zero. So this will actually modify the value in memory in place. So it increments it by one, and if it turns to zero, it will skip the next instruction. So this is how you would loop in PDP-8 assembly. You would put a negative value somewhere in memory, you will keep increasing it until it becomes zero, and then your loop is done. You can deposit, as I said, and then you have two jump instructions. Jump to subroutine, which jumps to a given location, and it will store the return address so that you can go back to where you came from. And then you have a jump, which is unconditional and does not store the return address. Okay, IO instructions. I have written a small subroutine that reads a character from a terminal, or rather a serial line, but you would attach your teletype or your perhaps early VT05 glass terminal to your PDP-8 computer. And IO instruction is quite interesting on the PDP-8 in that it has room in the instruction for a device address. So that's something you would define beforehand, that a certain address corresponds to the paper tape reader or the tape drive or something like that. Of course, there was a convention in how to number these devices, so it was rarely a mystery to the developers. And then in the instruction, there is also a few bits. I think there are 3 bits, which is up to the device itself to define what they mean. So these 3 bits would be sent over to the device, and the device would be able to do something depending on its own internal state, or it could use the system bus to influence what the CPU would do next. So the first instruction here, KSF, is checking a flag in the keyboard, or rather the input of the serial line, to see if there is a character there. If there would be a character just read, it would skip the next instruction. So the next instruction is just a jump one step back. Here you have some assembly syntax to get the current address of this instruction. So that's the dot, and then subtract one. So you would just jump one step back. So it will loop here indefinitely until it gets a character typed by the user. And then KRB, read buffer, would read that character. And then we add a constant, and here is just showing you some assembly syntax to get the value of lowercase a, subtracting the value of uppercase a, which is then 32. And by adding that to the value you just read, you would transform the lowercase, assuming the terminal is in lowercase mode, to uppercase. So then you have the IO instruction for outputting a character, TPC, and then you would jump back to this label upper in order to get the next character. All right, so that's 2 types of instructions done. Let's talk about the operate, or the microcoded instructions. These are really the one we are interested in for the rest of this presentation. They are called microcoded in the manuals, but they are not microcoded as you would know from a modern CPU. There is no code store for microcode in the CPU. It's just that within the instruction format, you have a set of bits. I think they are 7 or 8 bits that you can set. And the CPU will execute the corresponding function. So if you have a bit set in position 1, whatever that means will be executed. So you can combine these different sub-instructions to do different things, and it's rather clever, and they can be used for many different things. The first and simplest of these is just CLA, clear accumulator. So this line would just set one of these microcoded bits. The second line would set two of these bits to clear the accumulator and clear the link bit. The link bit is the overflow bit for arithmetic operations. Next is introducing the IAC, or increment accumulator, and the rotate accumulator left. So it's a shift instruction. So this row here would clear the accumulator, increment it by 1, and then shift it 1 step to the left. So you would essentially put the number 2 in the accumulator. Now you might think that the order here which you write them is the order they would be executed, but that's not the case. You could actually put these in any order in your program. The bit pattern would become the same. The order is predefined by the CPU. These microcoded instructions come in certain groups, and the order they are executed is predefined. So here the clear accumulator would be executed first, and then increment, and then rotate, because that is, I guess, what made most sense. There are also some logic tests that you can do, such as skip positive accumulator. So you would skip an instruction if the AC is 0 or more. You could combine it with skip non-zero accumulator. So you would skip if the accumulator was at least 1. But as it turns out, you can combine these in more ways than sort of makes sense. So what does it mean to skip a positive accumulator and rotate it left at the same time? Maybe that does something, maybe not. So not all of these combinations really do make sense. For instance, what happens if you rotate left and right at the same time? As it turns out, the documentation from Digital will help us out here a little bit. They have a page on legal micro instructions combinations. And from this table, we won't go into detail here, you can see the matrix of available micro instructions and what combinations is possible. So all here means that it works on all models of the PDP-8. This manual is written just after the 8i and 8l was released, so it doesn't include the 8e and 8a. But as you can see, some of these combinations are only available for some of the models. Some combination doesn't make sense on any model. And you also get a hint on the right-hand side here. It says logical event times. So that shows you the order in which these instructions are executed, and you can see that there is a slight difference between between the models. So as you might imagine, this lower right hand side of this table is actually what enables us to identify which CPU we are running on. So the behavior is going to be different. So I think we're soon ready to dive into the actual code here. So here is the first line of the machine subroutine. It's a comment that tells you what the subroutine will return. Once you call the machine subroutine and it's done, it will leave a value in the accumulator from 0 to 13, indicating which model you are executing on. And as you can see here, so we have some comments on the differences between them. It's the incompatible one, the real one, slow one, strange, orange, green, fast, wide. So perhaps an insight in what Charles thought about these machines. I have somewhat reorganized the code. If you were to go to the source code of Kermit, it would be slightly different, but I think I have done it in order to hopefully make it a bit easier to follow. But you would definitely recognize the code if you were to look it up and study it yourself. Okay, so assume now then that we are stepping through this code running on some machine. We don't know which machine it is, but once the code is done, it's gonna, once the code is certain which model we are executing on, it's gonna jump to one of these labels. So if we identify it as a Harris 6120 microcontroller, it's going to end up here, and it's going to increment the accumulator by one, and then it's just going to fall through and increment the accumulator 13 times. And if the code cannot figure out what machine it is, we're going to jump to I'm unknown, which will not increment the accumulator, and of course then leave a zero in the AC. So remember then, when you see one of these, a jump to one of these labels, you will know that the corresponding value will be set in AC, and the subroutine is done. So let's first try to figure out if we are running on a PDP-5. And please feel free to stop me here if you have any questions or if I'm going too fast. I'll do my best to explain this comprehensively. So we're first going to start by clearing the accumulator and the link, so we have all zeros. Then we're going to load the value of address position, address location 0. And we're going to store it somewhere in a temporary variable. That's just in order to restore it when the subroutine is done. But as it turns out, the PDP-5 hardwired its program counter to address 0. So that's, you could access the program counter register that way, which is only available on the PDP-5. You could not read or manipulate the program counter like that on the other models. So what we are doing here then is, after clearing the accumulator, we are loading the address of this IMF5 label that we saw on the previous slide. And by putting that back using deposit to address location zero, we are forcing the program counter to the return to the return gauntlet, as Charles call it. Obviously, on all the other machines, you're not affecting the program counter, so you would just continue executing the rest of the subroutine. So, if we were on a PDP-5, we would be done already. But let's assume that we're not on a PDP-5, so we're continuing and trying to figure out who we are. So, what we do then is just to restore that temporary value. This is just to be polite to whoever called us. If there was an important value on memory location zero, we put it back. And here already you can see we are starting to look at the microcoded instructions in order to figure out what we are. So the first two are simple. We clear the accumulator, we clear the link bit, so we have all zeros. And then we use the CMA or complement accumulator to flip all the bits into ones. And then we do a rotate right and a rotate left in the same instruction. So we're taking this register of bits and we're shifting it one step to the left and one step to the right. So, and as it turns out, on the 8i and 8l, you would expect a zero to be shifted in from one direction. But if you were doing the other direction, you would shift in a zero in the other direction. As it turns out here, we do both and we OR the result in the accumulator. So we subtract this octal value, 3776, which is just all the 12 bits of the accumulator with the first and the last bit set to zero. So by subtracting this constant and checking if the result is zero, we know that we are either on an 8i or 8l. So, but let's assume that we are not, or sorry, rather, let's assume that we are an 8i or 8l. We need to differentiate between them. So we're going to end up in this part of the subroutine, where we start by clearing the accumulator and complementing it. So we put the octal value 7777 in the accumulator. And here is a bit of funky syntax. It turns out actually that the clear accumulator instruction can be encoded in several different ways. Because if you had an expansion of the PDP-8, which was called the extended arithmetic element, which gave you hardware multiplication and hardware division, then you got a few more of these microcoded instructions. And when you were executing those microcoded instructions, you might also want to clear the accumulator. So you got a second way of encoding the clear accumulator instruction. And that's what's happening on this line. And the exclamation mark just means OR. So we're ORing this instruction with 401. The reason is probably because the assembler that Charles used didn't have a mnemonic for this instruction, this way of encoding the clear accumulator. Long story short, we are running the extended arithmetic element version of CLA. And because the 8i, the 8L is the cost reduced version, it didn't have the extended it didn't have the possibility of the extended arithmetic element, so it doesn't have this clear accumulator version. So, but the 8i, being the bigger brother, has this functionality. So here we can differentiate between those two, and we can figure out that we are an 8L or not. So let's assume that we are not an 8L. We have figured out then that we are an 8i. But we still have to figure out if we are a PDP-12 or not. The PDP-12 was implemented with the 8i CPU. So here we are looking at some code specific to the PDP-12. The first instruction is actually an IO instruction called link. In order to go into this link mode and start executing link instructions, so the first instruction is then a link instruction in order to complement the AC. And then we can go back to PDP mode with the PDP IO instructions. And we can increment the accumulator. So if we are on a PDP-12, we are putting all ones in the accumulator. And that's the representation for negative one. We are incrementing the accumulator. So negative one plus one is zero. And if we are, then get zero back, we know that we are on a PDP-12. These three instructions, the IO instructions, actually becomes a no operation, a NOP instruction on every other PDP-8 model, because these device addresses used for the link IO instructions has not been reused for any other device. So we have three instructions that doesn't really do anything. So this test will then become false, and we know that we are an 8i. Okay, so we have identified quite a few of the models, but so assume then that we were not an 8i or 8L or PDP-12. Then we would have ended up in the part that tries to identify the PDP-8S. And what we're trying to do then is to clear the accumulator, complement it, and rotating the accumulator left. And the PDP-8S couldn't do this, and that's because the order these micro instructions are executed is different on the 8S. The 8S would actually try to execute the complement and the rotate instruction at the same time, which is not possible. So it will not put the expected value of 776 in the accumulator. So it's a simple test. And you can see here in the comment what Charles thought about this CPU. The 8S wasn't that successful. It was slow, and it was even so slow that it would not work properly with the deck tape drives, which were really popular for the PDP-8 models. Okay, but if we're not an 8S, we will end up here, and we will execute an instruction called BSW byte swap, and that is on an instruction introduced with the 8E. I guess the designer of the CPU had figured out that rotating left and right at the same time was a waste of instruction space. So they decided to introduce the byte swap, which would take the upper half of the accumulator and swap it with the lower half. So turning one of these meaningless combinations of the microcoded instruction into something useful. So the result would be octal 100. And if that's not implemented, and with all of the other tests that we have done, we can conclude that we are either running on a straight 8 or we are on a omnibus machine. So an omnibus machine is then the EF, M, or A, and EF and M being this exactly the same computer with different labels. But in order, we can differentiate between the 8E and the 8A, and I think this part is the one that I think is hardest to explain. So, but in order to understand it, we have to look at the instruction format of the PDP-8. And what we have here is on the left side, how a memory referencing instruction would be encoded in a 12-bit word. So the first three bits here, 00, 01, 02, is the opcode. So that is how you would differentiate between a deposit or an increment skip zero and a jump instruction, for instance. Then you would have two bits which determines the addressing mode, and then you would have seven bits that gives you a memory address within the current page that you are executing code in. On the right hand side, you would have the instruction format for the operate instruction. The first three bits would always be ones. Then you would have one bit which will give you a group of operate instructions. And this is, in this example, it's group zero. So you can see here that the lowest eight bits, or the rightmost eight bits, gives you the different instructions that you can encode within this group. The number below here is the order in which they are executed. But anyway, the reason I'm showing this is that you should remember that when you're referencing memory, the rightmost part of the address is taken from the instruction word itself, the rightmost part. And in an operate instruction, the rightmost part tells you what to do, what instruction to execute. Okay, let's look at the code. So what we're trying to do here is to execute two instructions called rotate to left and rotate to right. So it was possible to set to shift one step or two steps, either left or right. But if you do both, well, that's sort of undefined, and strange things happens on the omnibus machines. If nothing happens, we get a zero value, I think. Yes, we are executing one of the micro controllers. Otherwise, we're going to take this value. Since I'm running a bit short of time, I'm not going to go into the details, but what we're doing here is we're composing a value where the leftmost part is the address of the current page, which you would get if you were doing a memory referencing instruction. And the rightmost part is part of the instruction for the operate instruction. What is strange is that the memory address would never end up in the accumulator. It would go into a internal register for the CPU called the memory address register. But for some reason on the 8E, part of the memory decoded memory address ends up in AC together with part of the instruction itself. So that's what we're comparing here. And if we get this value, we know that we are an 8E. The 8A does a similar thing, but it in practice loads the value of the next memory address. So the instruction would be on one address and the accumulator would get the address of the next instruction. So with this constant here, we can figure that out and realize that we are on an 8A. And if we are not running on one of the microcontrollers, 8E or 8A, we are on one of the unknowns. And here is a page from the PDP-8E maintenance manual. And I think that here we can sort of see the reason. I'm not a hardware guy myself, but I think here we can see the reason for this, the value that it ends up in the accumulator. And we can see that there are three lines here in the CPU responsible for decoding the right shift, left shift, and if it's done once or twice. But we also have two gates here, which is used to decode the AND instruction, which is a memory referencing instruction. And we can see that the result of that decode goes to the same line. So there's something here in the CPU getting confused, whether it's in trying to decode micro coded instruction or a memory reference instruction. But good for us, we can differentiate between the two CPUs. Okay, finally then, and I guess this is almost the last slide of the presentation. The next to last, we know that we are one of the micro controllers, and we execute rotate accumulator left and rotate accumulator right. So here, the designers of the 6120 also figured out that this is a combination that has not been used for anything useful. Let's use it to shift left three steps. So it allows you to shift the contents of the AC to the left three steps. There is no way to shift to the right three steps. They just found one, a free sort of free instruction and decided to use it for this. So then we can separate the 6120 and 6100. And last but not least, we have covered all the models except for the Link 8. So we have figured out that we are a straight 8 computer if we end up here, but we might be a Link 8. So we start by clearing and complementing the accumulator, and we're using a specific IO instruction for the Link 8 that transfers what's called the Link A register. This is a register that's only available on the Link 8. We transfer that to AC, the other way around. We transfer the contents of AC into the A register. We clear the AC and we load it back. We load, we get the value from the A register back into AC. And by incrementing it, if we get a negative value, we increment it, it might become zero. And then we know if we are a link 8. Otherwise, we are a straight 8. And we have successfully identified all of the DEC PDP-8 models. And if you're wondering if there are anything, if there is anything else to identify, what would be an unknown? It looks like we have covered all the models, but there are actually quite a few PDP-8 models implemented by other actors. And there are a lot of clones made in Hungary, in Russia, Cuba even, as a rather mysterious machine, not much known about. But there were also clones made in the US. There are a few known of these machines. Some of these were just using the microcontroller, which was free to buy for anyone, and use in their design. So if you own one of these machines, or knows if someone does, maybe we can figure out how they are compatible or incompatible with the DEC machines. Okay, I think I almost made it in time, and it's time for questions, so feel free to ask anything. Doesn't have to be PDP-8 related.
All right, thanks a lot, Pontus. First question is already coming up.
Soll ich vor die Kamera, oder? Yeah. I have a question. I'm coming from the Computer Museum in Stuttgart, and we have some machines, and PDP-12 and an SBC-6120, where we didn't couldn't run the Kermit 8 from Charles Lasner. It runs fine with our PDP 8, with our LAP 8E. There runs Johnny Bilquist's Kermit and Charles Lasner's Kermit. I don't know if we have the newest version, because it worked, and when we got the PDP-12 and the SBC-6120, we couldn't run this. Do you know, are there newer versions or modified versions from Kermit 8 which run on the PDP-12 or on the SBC-6120? 120. You said that Kermit finished at 92. I got the LAP 8E in 1991. So the first thing I come to run was Kermit 12 from Charles Lasner, and I never looked for a newer version or a modified version.
That's a good question. The only version that I have looked at is the 92 version, which is available for download from, is it University of Columbia's page, or an archive of that web page. There is in the source code a version history, and there are some mentions about which model PDP-8 is supported by which version. As far as I understand it, that the latest version should run on all models, so you won't have to search for a specific version for a specific model. But I can only speak from reading the code. I haven't tried running Kermit myself on all of these models.
It may be that there are other people modified Kermit to run on these machines. It identifies the PDP-12 and it identifies SPC's 6120 correctly. It may also be the SPC emulates PDP-8 I/O instructions because it has not the original hardware. It may be that there's a firmware bug in the version that I have.
Yes, it might be. If I recall correctly, the 6120 tries to be as close to an 8E as possible, even though the CPU itself is slightly incompatible. Specifically when it comes to how the serial interface is implemented. With that statement, it sounds like whatever works on your lab 8, I guess it's a lab 8E.
Yes, it's a lab 8.
Would work on the SPC 6120 as well. So, yeah, maybe it's a configuration issue. You have to set up the device codes for the serial interface.
No, they are the same. It's 03 and 04. But I try to make a single line Kermit protocol. Normally, Kermit uses for data transfer the auxiliary line 30 and 40. But I'm trying to make it over a single line to make data transfer over the terminal, over the console line. I don't know if there's an official version for single line data transfer or if the Kermit has to be patched to do this.
Unfortunately, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Okay, it may be a misconfiguration. It's possible. Okay, then I try to find out what happens. I have other ways to download. Many people, the SPC 6120, put out the disk and load it with other tools, so they don't need the Kermit. But I don't have this possibility, so I want to use Kermit, and I will try and find out. Thank you.
I have a 6120 myself, so I would be interested to see if it if we could get Kermit well running on that.
Okay.
But it's been a while. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, one quick other question, if there is one, then we have to close for the next talk. No, okay. But only a very, very short one, because we need to go to
second system, the SPC, the Intercept Junior. I have one of this, and I also have an Intercept sampler. What use would it be to run Kermit on these systems? They have no mass storage, and they have only small memory. Is it an academic interest to find out if it would run?
Yes, I suppose. But given that they are so similar to the other machines that are built on the 6100, I guess it would just be fun to see it running, but not much would come out of it.
All right, thanks very much, Pontus.
Thank you for listening, everyone. I hope you got a little bit more knowledge about the PDP-8 after this.
Thanks very much, Pontus. Yes, we did. Very fancy. Thanks.